B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, December 12th, 2016. We've seen a big dump of spook dust in Washington, D.C. But none of it amounts to proof that Russia intervened in our elections and favored Donald Trump. These are tissues of lies, and we've got to peel them away one by one. First of all, let me begin with the simple truth. No matter what you believe, no matter what the groupthink inside the Beltway is, no matter what the CIA, the FBI, and members of Congress have to say, let's start with what I believe to be the truth about the hacked information from the Democratic National Committee and from John Podesta's email account. And I'm going to correct myself out of the gate here. I used the word hacked. And this information was leaked. It was not hacked. My source on this is Craig Murray. He is a former British ambassador. He won an award this year for being a whistleblower. And he is close to Julian Assange. In fact, Craig Murray says that he has met the person who leaked this information. None of this is being reported in the corporate media here in the United States. I am linking to Craig Murray's blog, and you can read his commentary with your own eyes. In an interview that he gave to The Guardian after the story was broken by The Washington Post on Friday night that the CIA believes that Russia is responsible, and there are a lot of weasel words in there. There is not a single quote from a named source. It is all based on anonymous official leaks, the kind of leaks that never draw an investigation or a prison sentence or the threat of an indictment under the Espionage Act. So let me read a paragraph that was posted by the British newspaper The Guardian for 3 hours before it was taken down and replaced by something else. And this is quoted by Craig Murray in his blog. The article read, "The Kremlin has rejected the hacking accusations, while the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has previously said the DNC leaks were not linked to Russia. A second senior official cited by the Washington Post conceded that intelligence agencies did not have specific proof that the Kremlin was, quote, directing, end quote, the hackers, who were said to be one step removed from the Russian government." Let me interject here. What is one step removed? Well, that might be the equivalent of the military and surveillance contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton, who reap big profits working for the U.S. government. Or it could be something different. Craig Murray gave this quote to The Guardian newspaper. "They are absolutely making it up. The CIA claims are bullshit." Quote, "I know who leaked them," Murray said. "I've met the person who leaked them, and they are certainly not Russian, and it's an insider. It's a leak, not a hack. The two are different things. If what the CIA are saying is true, and the CIA statement refers to people who are known to be linked to the Russian state, they would have arrested someone if it was someone inside the United States. America has not been shy about arresting whistleblowers, and it's not been shy about extraditing hackers. They plainly have no knowledge whatsoever." So let's start there, and then we dive into the follow-up story. The New York Times competitive juices were enabled by the story that was leaked by the Post. And so based on a perhaps different set of anonymous sources, there isn't a single identified quotable person here. The New York Times on Sunday published that the judgment about Russia is built on, quote, a swell of evidence. American spy and law enforcement agencies are united in the belief that the Russian government had deployed computer hackers to sow chaos during the campaign. Last week, the CIA presented lawmakers with a stunning new judgment that upended the debate. Russia, they said, had intervened with the primary aim of helping make Donald J. Trump president. The CIA's conclusion does not appear to be the product of specific new intelligence obtained since the election. Rather, it was an analysis of what many believe is overwhelming circumstantial evidence. So, again, this is evidence-free. There isn't a shred of proof being offered, and yet the consensus is building, the momentum behind these assertions. And I'm seeing people who I respect, and I'll name a name, Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, put up a Facebook post saying that he now believes that Russia did attempt to tilt the election toward Trump. And I'm sorry, Stephen, I'll change my position when I see some actual proof. And this New York Times article just recites what we already know from the summer, how the leaks surfaced right in time for the Democratic convention, led to embarrassment and the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, etc. But we're seeing differences between the FBI and the CIA about the results of their respective investigations, and it is fair to say that the CIA is not bound to the same standards that the FBI should be bound to and occasionally is. So we now have a conflict in the intelligence law enforcement communities here in the United States. The president-elect says that he flatly doesn't believe it. He says that I think it's ridiculous. It's just another excuse. I don't believe it. And his campaign team, or the transition team, was apparently authorized by the Donald on Friday to hammer the CIA by saying these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, I have my issues with the CIA, but I'm not sure it's the same analysts from 12, 14 years ago who, made those wrong recommendations to the Bush White House that were described as slam dunk. But I think that it is overall a fair pushback on the spy agency. Now, it's also interesting that we've learned that Trump is not taking his daily intelligence briefing. He is so smart, he says, that he doesn't need to talk to them every day. That's pretty arrogant, and it could be that kind of attitude that is causing people inside the CIA to organize against Trump. Republican congressional leaders who have studiously avoided crossing Donald Trump on this issue weighed in today, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, says he supports congressional investigations of the possible Russian cyber attacks to influence the election. And his cohort in the House of Representatives, Speaker Paul Ryan, piped up as well. As I've said before, any foreign intervention in our elections is entirely unacceptable, and any intervention by Russia is especially problematic because under President Putin, Russia has been an aggressor and consistently undermines American interests. So this sets up a inter-party squabble. Even before the new Congress has been seated and before Trump gets to take an oath of office. So this portends real splits in the Republican Party. They have announced that Richard Burr and John McCain, two very conservative senators, Burr from North Carolina, are going to co-chair these investigations. And it could take months for all of this to unravel. A lot of it will be done in closed sessions without any public release of information. So this is going to be with us for a while, and understand that from my point of view, it is entirely concocted. And as I've said before, if proof is provided, I will change my mind and I will change my public position. But so far, I haven't seen it. Now, one of the rivalries has to do with the issues of who supported whom in the presidential campaign. And Mike Morrell, who wanted to be CIA director, cast his lot with Hillary Clinton. He went public. You know that there are many members of the National Security and Intelligence Establishment who signed on to a letter. I think there are at least 51 of them. Mike Hayden, former head of the CIA and the NSA, is kind of their front man. And he publicly has attacked Michael Flynn, the lieutenant general who used to run the Defense Intelligence Agency and is truly an outlier with the cozy NSA-CIA establishment. And Hayden criticized Mike Flynn, saying Mike tweets even more than his boss. Now, if you go back to August, the letter that was signed by Hayden and others make it clear that there is a real rift And when Trump heard, as I mentioned, on Friday, this information, he slammed the intelligence community for their failures back in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Here's a former CIA and FBI official, Philip Mudd. "I'm watching a clown show," he said. And he criticized Flynn for his speech at the Republican National Convention, where he led the crowd in anti-Hillary Clinton lock her up chants and really, you know, tipped his hand. So we have this kind of partisanship that has affected the intelligence community and the various arms of that community. And this is not going to go well. I can just tell you, this is the beginning of a real mess. And who knows what else will surface from it. I'm linking in the show file to today's podcast to Glenn Greenwald's animated takedown of these issues published over the weekend. His headline reads, "Anonymous leaks to the Wash Post about the CIA's Russian beliefs are no substitute for evidence." And in his lawyerly way, Greenwald really just dismantles the unattributed claims, the fact that it's based on unnamed sources. He says the anonymous officials also claim that intelligence agencies have identified individuals with connections to the Russian government who provided WikiLeaks with thousands of hacked emails. And he goes on to say that the New York Times, that I cited earlier, has other anonymous officials. And so we have dueling official leakers. And as I mentioned, these are the kind that never get investigated or punished because, well, they have high-ranking positions. So we also see some caveats in the Washington Post story buried. In the article, it said intelligence agencies do not have specific intelligence showing that officials in the Kremlin were directing the identified individuals to pass this along to WikiLeaks. And again, WikiLeaks denies that their information came from the Russian government. So it is fascinating to see how Putin is dismissed, how Assange is dismissed, because the know-it-alls in the spook establishment have said it, and therefore we can't believe these other people. And I've noticed that in television coverage, when the B-roll is there, B-roll is when the anchor is talking and they just put up pictures to keep us distracted. When they talk about this, they always put up pictures of Putin himself. And there is no indication so far that Putin had anything to do with this. But the imagery, the overall consensus view, is really being crammed down our throats by a willing media. Greenwald also says that there is quite a bit of lying that goes on. After all, the people who work for the CIA are professional, systematic liars. And Greenwald says no one that what we have seen are assertions disseminated by anonymous people, completely unaccompanied by any evidence, let alone proof. And so I really value the clear thinking and skeptical approach that Glenn Greenwald takes. He says, who are the people summarizing these claims to the Washington Post? What motives do they have for skewing the assertions one way or the other? And it is amazing how there really is little demand from elected officials or from high-ranking media figures for proof. It's just good enough because it fits into a narrative that's already been pretty clearly established. There's also, as Greenwald points out, this struggle between CIA and FBI, and the FBI issues are further complicated by James Comey's initial refusal to charge Hillary Clinton and what we believe is backlash among the rank and file at the FBI that led to his kind of bizarre pronouncements toward the end of the campaign. So the other thing that Greenwald points out is the McCarthyite tactics that have been used by the Democrats during this entire cycle. And he says those who question, criticize, or are perceived to impede Hillary Clinton's smooth and titled path to the White House are vilified as stooges, sympathizers, or agents of Russia. And I've heard some of that myself. So it's going to be an ongoing story. There's no question about it. And will it affect the Electoral College? We'll get to that story in a bit. But first, I want to talk about the claims that this election was rigged. not by Russia, but by Republicans who gamed the system with voter suppression tactics. And then as recounts were rolled out by Green Party candidate Jill Stein in just three states, they used every available tactic to shut it down. And the shutdown is pretty clear. Pennsylvania has announced a federal judge has rejected the request for a recount, and state law presented so many barriers there that it was unlikely that anything else could occur. In Michigan, the Supreme Court there put the final nail in the coffin of the recount there on Friday, and Wisconsin election officials expect to complete their so-called recount, but it's really just a retabulation of the tabulation. And from what we can see, there have been some hand-counted ballots, but not the majority. And we're expecting only a minor change of less than 100 votes in the final tally in Wisconsin. But in Michigan, where Jill Stein held a rally on Saturday and threw in the towel in freezing temperatures in Detroit, she's described this as a political horror show. And one of the issues relates to what is a recountable ballot. And the games they play in Michigan are that if you've got a tub of ballots, a box, and the outside marking says there are 100 ballots inside, and when you open it up there are less than 100 or more than 100, then those ballots cannot be recounted or maybe even counted for the first time. And in some areas, more than half of the ballots were tagged as unrecountable. We get a first-person account of the effort to recount votes in Michigan last week from Ray Lutz, an activist from San Diego. Ray Lutz has just returned from Michigan, where he was part of the recount operation. He's an activist from San Diego who has protected elections and also fought the corrupt Public Utilities Commission over nuclear power plant shutdowns here in California. Ray, first of all, thanks for going to Detroit. I got a lot out of a Facebook Live feed that you posted over the weekend, and I want you to share some of that information with our listeners. One of the things I noted in a post from a guy named Nick Sharp, who was an observer with the Recount Michigan operation, he says that Trump's lawyers were just all over the place and raising objections, doing everything they could to, in his words, gum up the works and disqualify whole precincts. How stage-managed was the recount, and was Stein outnumbered and outgunned by Trump's lawyers?
Well, absolutely, and thanks a lot, Peter, for letting me be on your show. I really admire the work that you do. So first of all, yes, you know, everywhere that I went, they had Trump, not just the attorneys, but the volunteers were at every single table, and it wasn't just the attorneys that were gumming things up. You know, those volunteers, the observers, are not supposed to, in theory, be actively involved or talking to the people trying to count the ballots. They're supposed to sit there, and if they have an objection, they're supposed to raise it separately. But these people were badgering the counters, making it so that they could never get anything done. And surprisingly, one that I watched in Detroit, the counters could never get the same count of the ballots. Just counting not the votes. We're talking just count the ballots and how many are there. Sounds like a trivial thing to do. But when you have people badgering you, you know, over it, and you can't have a train of thought, you can never get the count. So they didn't get the count to match more than, they counted it three times, couldn't get it to match it twice in a row. It was always a different number. And then since it didn't match the paperwork, then they deemed that unrecountable, thrown out, and then it's not going to be reviewed.
Yeah, and this is one of the dirty secrets that we discovered, that recount rules are different from state to state. And in Michigan, it's a pretty oppressive process from the point of view of those who want a recount and an honest result. Ray, take a couple of minutes here to share with our listeners your key findings, in particular, the 75,000 undervotes, people who went and filled out a ballot but decided not to vote for president, and all of those were concentrated in Detroit, in Wayne County. I smell a rat, but we're not ever going to get to the rat's nest on this case.
Well, the biggest thing here is what you said, is that this thing that they call unrecountable precincts. So, and there's many, many ways for this to happen. so that they have this hair trigger. When they pull a precinct out, they first go through a list of things. Now, is it sealed right in the box? Does the seal number match? Was it written down correctly? Is the number of ballots, does it match the number on the form? And that number on the form, I've looked at those. They're just handwritten. They're crossed out, redone a few times. It's not like you have a real, solid number to work with to begin with. And then you're using that to determine whether or not the precinct is unrecountable. And extrapolating what they had done so far, they were going to have nearly 500,000 ballots that were deemed unrecountable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in a state where, you know, there was only 11,000 between the two main candidates. How can you just disregard 500,000 ballots?
Right.
So what was happening was this was basically becoming such a huge problem that I believe they had to shut it down. And they came up with this lame excuse that Jill Stein did not have sufficient standing and you know, pulled the plug on it.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that I see, though, is with this unrecountable, it'd be very easy to cause any precinct to become unrecountable. All you got to do is have a voter go in, get a ballot, sign in, and then not put it in the box. Done. So the number of signatures doesn't match the number of ballots in the box. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that's unrecountable. Then you can fix that one.
Well, and in some jurisdictions, weren't the unrecountable precincts as high as 60%?
Well, that was in the report that I saw. It was around 50%, but I'd have to confirm that. It was in the Detroit City area,
mm-hmm.
where that wasn't a full county, the Wayne County, but just looking at the city area, which is the, you know, the most, you know, black area of the state.
Right.
Whereas if you go up, there was still a very high number, though, extremely high up in the Flint, Michigan area.
Mm-hmm.
It was really high up there. They had barely even gotten started. And at the end, you had, just looking at the ones that they did recount, and I have to make the correction from what I said, or some people thought that the statistics that the state gave that said these were the recounted precinct numbers. And the recounted numbers, Hillary Clinton was ahead, and when they cut it off, by 74,000 votes.
All right, now repeat that for our listeners. I understand that this is not a universal recount, but the snapshot of the precincts that were permitted to be recounted showed an increment for Hillary Clinton of 75,000 when the margin that Trump claimed victory on was less than 11,000.
Right, and what we thought at first was that those were the ballots that were actually recounted. Those were the precincts that were actually recounted and the ones that were accepted as the unrecountable precincts. Those are still considered recounted, even though they were never recounted. So they're included in the recounted precinct total of votes.
Mm-hmm.
So in most of the red counties that they have there, the places where Trump won, those were all finished. It was in the, you know, they had finished, not all of them, but many of them had finished their recount completely.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the counties that were dark blue had finished their recount. So it's very hard to know, to see, because places like Flint, which was a blue area, and Detroit, blue, and Ann Arbor, blue, those areas had not finished.
Mm-hmm.
And hadn't really even gotten started. Genesee County, which is Flint, had barely gotten started.
Now,
so it's hard
to imagine that
Trump could make up that 75K.
There's much more to the story, but in the interest of time here, can I just ask you, did it bother you that Hillary Clinton's lawyers didn't appear to be in the room and were not really seriously pursuing this recount? After all, she is the one who could have benefited had it gone to term.
Absolutely. This whole thing about Hillary Clinton is absolutely disgusting. I mean, she should have been there fighting this fight. She claims to be a fighter. She's completely absent, had told her people not to object to anything and just sit there and be observers without any kind of real, way to be effective. They were completely absent. She could have been taken the reins of this and caused it to go forward and to complete. So it's mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling, that she wasn't there. But, I'm not a big Hillary fan, so it's not the first time I've been dismayed by her actions.
Ray Lutz, thanks for being there for us, and thanks for sharing some information here about attempted recount in Michigan.
Yeah, citizensoversight.org for more information. Thanks, Peter.
My thanks to Ray Lutz and all of the people who converged from around the nation for the recounts in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Now, some electors, members of the Electoral College, are getting a little bit active. And we have a case here in California where Christine Pelosi, who is an elector, she is pledged to Hillary Clinton, has joined a lawsuit asking for intelligence briefings for the members of the Electoral College before they cast their votes for president on December 19th. And Pelosi is seconded by John Podesta, who chaired Hillary Clinton's campaign. And he says that electors have a solemn responsibility. We support their efforts to have their questions addressed. And Christine Pelosi, who is an attorney, is joined by a former member of Congress, New Hampshire's Carol Shea Porter, and three other colleagues from New Hampshire. And there are others who have signed on, including one Republican, Chris Suprin, who has he published an op-ed in the New York Times last week. He is a Republican who does not want to vote for Trump. And we have a Democratic elector from California, a man I know named Vince Kohler. And Vince is the chair of the Monterey County Democratic Party. And he has filed a lawsuit to challenge the requirement that he cast his vote for Hillary Clinton. It is an effort to win freedom for all electors to be unbound by the voters who made them electors. And Kohler's attorney wrote that though Clinton and Kane won the majority vote in California and are qualified for office, Vince Kohler cannot be constitutionally compelled to vote for them. Plaintiff must be allowed to exercise his judgment and free will to vote for whomever he believes to be the most qualified and fit for the offices of president and vice president within the circumstances and with the knowledge known on December 19th of 2016. Now, this is part of the so-called Hamilton Elector Movement, and there's a video that's circulating online, and it's fairly clever. Unfortunately, it's based on the same idea that Russians manipulated the election, and that's why we need to use the Electoral College to put the brakes on a Trump ascendancy. But they need 36 additional Republican electors spread across the country. So far, only Chris Suprin, who I mentioned from Texas, has openly broken ranks from Trump. And Trump's tweets are really annoying. I wrestle with them every day, whether they should be ignored or reported on. And today, he tweeted about something that I actually agree with. He says that the plan to build the new military jet, the F-35, is out of control. And this has caused the stock of the lead contractor, Lockheed Martin, to fall like a jet without an engine coming down from 50,000 feet. Anyway, this is dangerous territory because on the one hand, I think the F-35 is a pork barrel boondoggle, and I'd love to see the project canceled or at least the costs reduced. But to have a man who has a tenuous grip on being president-elect, much less being president himself, this is inappropriate behavior by Donald Trump. And yet, he's permitted to do this, and people just sit back and say, oh, it's Trump. He's tweeting again. Thanks for joining me today for my free news and comment podcast. It's available here every day at peterbcollins.com and on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.